Next Tuesday, the Supreme Court will hear opening arguments in a case about whether the Trump administration can add a question about citizenship to the 2020 census. Critics say asking the question, "Are you a citizen?" will lower response rates among Latino and immigrant households, a potential problem since the census determines things like how congressional seats are allocated and where federal funds flow. The Trump administration is claiming it needs this data to enforce the Voting Rights Act and that the census has asked about citizenship before. Let's get the history of the census with historians Nathan Connolly and Ed Ayers, hosts of the podcast Backstory. Welcome back.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks.
So, Ed, let's start with you. The sixth sentence in the U.S. Constitution establishes the census. Why was this so important to the founders?
Well, representative democracy. You need to know exactly how many people live in every part of the country that's being represented. And so they take for granted that every 10 years we're going to have to go to all that expense and trouble of counting everybody.
And it not just counts everybody, it also gives us a sense over time of how the country is changing.
Yeah, and they know from the beginning that there's a lot at stake. Not only does the Constitution create the census, but it also builds in a distortion from the very beginning. People will remember the Three-Fifths Compromise, in which five enslaved people count as three in terms of population. So the House of Representatives and the Electoral College are both kind of manufactured from the beginning by the census by, you know, giving the South this huge advantage. So, you know, the idea of the census sounds neutral in the Constitution, just count everybody. But from the very beginning, they add these distortions to it.
And Nathan, they also added a lot of questions over time.
Yeah, I mean, there were some efforts in the early going to try to think about what the country needed in terms of its commerce or other kinds of long-term planning. So, you know, someone like James Madison, who at the time was just a lowly Virginia congressman, is thinking about the early census in 1790 and wants to add categories on, say, various arts and professions, or wants to think about properly provisioning, you know, agriculture and commerce and manufacturing. And ultimately, Madison gets overruled, and he's almost threatened with the notion that what his proposals represent is a kind of threat to the Constitution itself. But the idea was never really off the table that the census should be used as a kind of living instrument to meet a variety of economic and political needs.
Ed, in 1850, the government must have been very concerned about the issue of slavery because the census in that year asked more questions about enslaved people than ever before.
Yeah, the one great continuity across the entire history of the census is that it singled out African-American people. And in 1850, they start bringing additional details. Now, no details such as people's actual names, but their gender, and strangely, whether or not the white census taker deems them to be black or mulatto of mixed race. Why that seems something the federal government would want to know about seems bizarre. But one byproduct of that was that Americans had a far more granular understanding of just how the North and the South were diverging. And people could look at these numbers and say, boy, the North really seems to be pulling ahead with all this immigration that's surging in from Ireland and Germany. And so the South looks at this, and there's a Southern white man named Hinton Rowan Helper who goes over these census numbers and points out that, look, non-slaveholding white people, you are the ones who are losing in all of this. The slaveholders are becoming rich, but look how the North's developing and you're not. The Republican Party prints over 150,000 copies of that book and distributes it all across the country right on the eve of the election of 1860. They think what this is going to do is to arouse non-slaveholding white people to vote for the Republicans. It doesn't. What it does is arouse them to be angry at the North. And so the law of unintended consequences.
Yeah, and by the time you get to the 1870s, Jeremy, you basically have to reconstruct the census from an antebellum census to a reconstruction census. And so the 1870s, you begin to see, you know, for the first time, you know, concerns and questions around people whose voting rights are infringed upon, because obviously it's in the interest of Congress to try to track who's had their voting rights impinged.
And they were actually asking that in the census.
Exactly. So this winds up being one of the questions. And enumerators were given very specific instructions to look for male citizens 21 years of age and upward, and specifically to ask the question whose rights to vote were denied. denied or abridged, and for for grounds that weren't having to do with having rebelled against the United States or having committed a crime, right? So really targeting African Americans who were disenfranchised and thinking about how you can then use that data to basically bring about a more just voting system mm-hmm. in the United States.
So there you have a case of the census questions being used to protect the rights of Americans, but the census has also been used to take them away. The most famous example being the U.S. internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Tell us more about how the census was used in that dark period in American history.
Yeah. So by the time you get to the late 1930s, there are efforts coming from the FBI, certain military intelligence agencies who are trying to basically relax the confidentiality rules around the census. And obviously, there are categories that are coming in and out of consideration. You know, long before that, of course, people are thinking about the Chinese in the 1870s, you know, whether or not to count Native Americans becomes a question in the late 19th century. But it really isn't until the 1940s where you have, you know, the retiring of the census director, a man named William Lane Austin, who tries to get in the way of FBI and military intelligence to keep some of the data confidential, and the arrival of a man named James Clyde Capt. And Clapt really does work kind of hand in glove with officials in the kind of law enforcement arm to begin to open up the possibility of basically aggregating and sharing data. And it's pretty incredible. I mean, you know, you have historians in the early 2000s who basically begin to uncover the Census Bureau providing kind of block-level information about those of Japanese ancestry living in California, Arizona, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, Idaho, Arkansas. And it really does force the Census Bureau in some ways to look back on the period and apologize. And so you have in 2000, the director of the U.S. Census, Kenneth Prewitt, have to issue a public apology for the Census Department's role in tabulating figures and providing, you know, information that allowed the U.S. government to directly infringe on the lives of American citizens. And so, you know, it's, I think, in one way, an interesting opening of an acknowledgement that the census is not simply an antiseptic or sterile documentation of American citizens, but that it really highlights the longer history of that particular instrument having been politicized.
Okay, so that brings us to what's happening right now and this question about whether the census should ask about citizenship, because there are a lot of people, as we know, living in this country who do not have proper documentation, and there's a fear that they're not going to want to answer the census now because they're worried if there's a question about citizenship that could be used against them if they say, I'm here, but I'm not a citizen.
Absolutely. You know, I think, you know, both Ed and I, when we look back on, you know, the census and you see the way in which people are encouraged, obviously, to respond and to try to get a proper accounting of where they live and the resources that are, you know, deployed by virtue of these numbers, you know, you look back and you say, well, gosh, you know, under slavery or under Reconstruction or under the Jim Crow period, just as, you know, three examples, obviously internment being another, you know, you would want to try to find ways to get the government to at least be accurate in figuring out who needs to get what to make society more equitable. But now we're seeing something that has a very dangerous kind of echo to other less progressive, you know, approaches to using the census.
Ed?
Yeah, the census over time, of course, is adapting constantly to new technologies, which allow it to be ever more invasive. It begins by people just knocking on your door and say, hey, who lives there? Mm-hmm. It's a different thing than the kind of technologies that we have today. And people can see that as the federal government is deciding what categories people fit in, who actually are we? How are we defined? And I think maybe amplified by, you know, what social media does in terms of invading privacy and so forth. I think that everything feels like it's of a new stake of importance right now.
The other thing that I think is a kind of echo to this earlier period is some of the arguments being made now before the court in terms of the case coming out of New York is that the Trump administration is trying to basically enforce voting rights, which, again, if you go back to the Reconstruction era, you know, language in terms of what it meant to really try to identify disenfranchisement as a problem and not simply have a blanket, you know, notion of there being, quote unquote, voter fraud or some kind of tampering with the electoral process to try to then elicit private information. You know, there was actually a template that's available for us to think about how we really could identify voting concerns if that were what was drawing us into this debate. And, you know, now that we see the court, you know, grappling with this, I mean, the lower court has been very, you know, clear in saying that there's a lot about this that feels as if there's a kind of subtext that is much more akin to older concerns about racial purity and whether or not we should be in the business of trying to police people on the basis of what we imagine America's racial purity to be.
Nathan Connolly and Ed Ayers, they are historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.